And in the NHL, the Blackhawks were off last night. They skate up in Edmonton tonight against the Oilers. Now the WGTD forecast from the National Weather Service for Tuesday, December 12th. Sunny and seasonal, a high today 37, looking ahead just a little bit. Tonight, sunset 417, partly cloudy and cold, a low of 22. Wednesday, sunny and 39. Thursday, sunny and 46. Friday, cloudy and 45. Saturday, partly sunny and 47. Sunday, partly sunny and 49. Right now, a little breeze from the northwest at 10:34 in Racine, 33 in Kenosha, 28 for Burlington, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Well, for the second time in the last two or three weeks, I have my sister Rondi to thank for a very special guest for the morning show. A couple of weeks ago, it was her recommendation that I seek out a certain author and a marvelous book. Today, I am very, very privileged to speak with somebody that my sister Rondi, who is a doctor, has worked with extensively and whose work she deeply admires, namely Dr. Rana Limbo, who is co-founder and now director emerita of something called Resolve Through Sharing, founded back in 1981, I believe, which has, for the last 40-plus years, made an enormous difference in the lives of all kinds of people who have suffered through bereavement of one kind or another, but particularly bereavement around the loss of a child or a stillbirth. And this program reaches out to people and also very much reaches out to healthcare professionals who are in a position to offer whatever help they can. And it is really Dr. Rana Limbo who has done as much as perhaps anybody in our country to help transform the way in which this kind of grief is approached and talked about. I mean, namely, talking about it, because once upon a time it was a kind of grief that far more often than not was sort of shoved under the rug and really not dealt with in any kind of meaningful way. And it's just crushing to think about how much pain was caused by that approach to this kind of grief. She and others have really helped to transform the way in which we think about this kind of grief and what we can do, particularly when it comes to caregivers of one kind or another, in ministering to those experiencing this kind of grief. Resolve Through Sharing, if I understand correctly, is part of the Gunderson healthcare system. And I'm so deeply honored to speak with Dr. Rana Limbo, who, by the way, has written a number of books on the topic as well, including When a Baby Dies, a handbook for helping and healing, as well as a book called Meaningful Moments, Ritual and Reflection When a Child Dies. That's just a couple of the books that she is responsible for. Dr. Rana Limbo, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you so much, Greg. I right away, when you were just speaking about how things have changed, a story came to mind, and I'd like to share it with you. A number of years ago, in fact, it was not probably 3 years or so after the program was founded, my colleague and I were part of an evening community program in a small town in Iowa. And attending that program, which was on the loss of a baby, the death of a baby, was a woman who we later learned was 80 years old. She was in a wheelchair, and her stillborn baby had died 60 years ago, and it was the first time that she had talked about her baby was that night at that program.
Wow.
80 years old.
Wow.
And, you know, I've never forgotten her. I can see her as plainly as if it were yesterday when I met her. And she had seen this community event advertised, and she knew that this applied to her, and she felt that this would be a place that where she would feel safe and protected. And so she came.
That's incredible. So. That is truly incredible. Tell us about your career in the medical field ahead of you co-founding Resolve Through Sharing. I believe you were a nurse at that point in time. Tell us what you had done, and then ultimately what you were seeing or hearing or experiencing that made you think that something needed to be done in terms of how these kind of losses were handled within the medical community.
Yes, I was a nurse and am a nurse. I graduated from St. Olaf's College with a Bachelor of Science in Nursing, and then I immediately attended the University of Colorado, where I got a master's in maternal child nursing. During my master's program and also during my time at St. Olaf, I had always been interested for some reason or other in the whole idea of childbearing and pregnancy and what that meant to people. And so I came to even my college experience with that sense of this is terribly important. And there are two things I'd like to share with you about that. I had a fabulous instructor in my maternity nursing course. And early on in that rotation, I was taking care of a mother, and I talked to my instructor about it, and I said, you know, she just doesn't seem interested in her baby, and I'm wondering what's going on. And she said, well, I think she probably needs something from you, and I think that you can give that to her. I think she needs some time and attention focused just on her. And so that's what I did for that period of time that I was taking care of her. I didn't force her to hold her baby or to talk about her baby, but I wanted to know more about her and how all of this was going. And she was a different person when I left that day. And I thank my professor for knowing that these are the sorts of things, even when there's not a death, these are the sorts of things that come up when you work in this area. I think everybody has a misconception actually, that it's always a happy place. And in reality, that isn't true. And so my interest in psych mental health and maternal child nursing sort of came together in this intersection. And so I remember that mother that I cared for. And then when I was getting my master's degree, I got very interested in the work of John Bowlby, who is known for attachment theory and was a psychiatrist and had worked with someone else who now I happen to know, Colin Murray Parks, in developing a model or a framework for grief. And I wrote a paper on it, and it intrigued me. And that stayed with me. And I went from that to working with mothers and babies. And then when this program began at Gunderson, someone on the planning committee knew that I was very interested in perinatal bereavement and that I might be interested in being the coordinator of the program. I was hired, and that was the beginning of Resolve Through Sharing in 1981.
Wow. I want to talk about how things once were. And I mean, that poignant story you told about the 80-year-old woman who in all of her life had never really openly talked about the devastating loss of her baby through stillbirth. And once upon a time, that was the norm. I mean, she just represents the tip of a gigantic iceberg of other mothers and fathers, for that matter, who, in a sense, suffered in silence through that kind of loss. I wonder to what you attribute that sort of veil of silence that so often surrounded this particular kind of death. I mean, are there explanations for that?
Well, Greg, it's a great question, and I feel like I have studied the history well enough to have what I consider to be at least a partial explanation. In the late 1800s, early 1900s, deaths frequently happened so that people were more involved in the death itself and in readying the body for a funeral, taking photos. It was not unusual at all during that time to take photos of people who died. And there are coffee table books devoted to this topic, which I find to be very interesting. I think what happened was when death and birth moved to a hospital setting, it became more of a patriarchal structure, and that during that period of time, there was less interest in what was important to the family and more interest in how healthcare professionals dictated how this should go. And so, to me, that's a perfect setup for silence. Whether people wanted to share or not, most of them did, they didn't feel that they could. It was, I know a number of women who have talked about that they were told not to see their baby after the baby died. And that's what you're asking about now, is that veil of silence that kind of surrounded this death. I have two uncles who died shortly after birth. And they were my mom's older brothers. And she spoke of them the entire time that I knew her. She loved those brothers. She was so sad that they didn't live so that she had older brothers. That loss was always with her. And so I think that it's an example of how changing a setting can change an entire culture around this really important part of grief and bereavement.
Right. And you utilize the term patriarchal to describe the structure of probably nearly every hospital setting, that by and large you had hospital administrators setting policy who would, with probably only the very rarest of exceptions, be men. And men trying to make pronouncements on how best to assist mothers with this kind of grief, being in no position to understand, in fact, what they were going through or what would be best for them.
Yes, and you know, during that time, men dominated medicine. Many babies were delivered during that time by family medicine physicians, and nearly all and then were men. And so the culture that developed then was that someone was in charge, and that person was likely a physician, and that person likely, I'm not saying always, but likely did not understand the depth of this loss for the family and those who were surrounding the family. We can talk about miscarriage too, because that's even another example of silence. People being afraid to even speak about it because it was, and still can be, seen as not as important.
Right.
And which, of course, I don't agree with, and I don't think anyone that works in this field would agree with that. But it's, you know, it's its own unique set of circumstances.
Right.
So there was a lot of suffering in silence. There was a lot of suffering and silence.
Another thing that I guess we probably should acknowledge is that we are talking about a period of time in which a whole lot of things were not talked about as openly as they often are talked about now. I mean, just in general, it seems as though people emotionally were not quite the open book that at least we quite often are today. But there seems to be around this at that point in time have been it's a very different sort of thing. It's not just people being reticent about exposing their feelings, their deepest feelings, but just of not even talking about it whatsoever, and of really trying in some ways to pretend like this didn't even happen, as though that were the best way for this to be handled. So it seems like around this kind of loss, we're talking about something distinct from other kinds of ways in which emotional losses or pain was not openly talked about.
And Greg, I think that part of this as well is that when an adult dies, even an older child, but, you know, when an adult dies, that person has a community of people who know them. And so that in and of itself makes a difference in how others respond to your grief, because they more than likely were acquainted with this person. It may be a family member, it may be someone in their neighborhood or community, someone who attends their church or synagogue, but there's a connection there that others feel, and therefore they're more apt to say something. But with a baby, that baby's connection and the people who really know that baby, that's a very small number. So you can understand why people might be hesitant to speak about it. I mean, things have changed so much in the last 40 to 50 years. They really have. But, you know, it still exists. One of the things that's very common to hear is that others are afraid that they will make, and that's oftentimes the word they use, make someone else cry. And that interpretation is, oh, they shouldn't, they don't want to be crying, and they shouldn't have to cry, therefore I will be silent, and I won't mention this. The exact opposite is true. But it's hard for people to know that that really is okay. I was just, you know, it just happened that the office sent me some old slides that I used during the time that Results of Sharing was beginning. And there's one, I took care of a family. I was working with mothers and babies, and I was assigned to a mother. Her husband was also there. Their baby had been stillborn a few days before. And on the bulletin board in their room was a message from their niece. And it said, "Dear so-and-so and so-and-so," the names of the parents, "I am so sorry your baby Lacey died. Love, Kathy." Hearts all over, kisses all over. And I looked at that and I thought, this is how everybody could respond. It was so meaningful. It was so beautiful. She knew to use the baby's name. She knew, she recognized them as parents, even though the baby didn't live. But she was six. She had, I always felt that this note, which we used in our teaching and our trainings, could help others learn what it means to acknowledge the presence of that baby in this family's life. I have always remembered that. I remembered exactly what it said. It was brief and to the point, but so meaningful.
Hmm. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Dr. Rana Limbo, Director Emerita and co-founder of a program called Resolve Through Sharing, that for more than 40 years has been working with various kinds of healthcare workers and caregivers around the topic, particularly of perinatal and pediatric bereavement, and helping to equip medical professionals to more effectively deal with the patients who have suffered this kind of really terrible loss. And this organization, or this group, was founded at a time when the prevailing wisdom in quotes, was for this kind of loss to be talked about very, very little, if at all, and for this very, very painful grief to be, in a sense, shoved down deep or shoved off to the side, and supposedly to be forgotten. And of course, one does not forget this kind of grief. So, Dr. Limbo, if I have described Resolve Through Sharing as a program designed really with healthcare professionals, am I right about this? That
yes.
So right from the outset, this is what you were thinking about. I'm just curious. I mean, another possibility would have been for you to create some kind of group that, in a sense, was dealing directly with the bereaved. But you clearly saw your role as not so much that as this other thing, of which in a sense would have far wider impact, I should think. But talk for a moment about your decision to want to focus your energies and expertise to addressing the problem in this particular way.
I appreciate being asked this, because I like to draw attention to two maternal nurse practitioners, was their role at Gunderson, who cared for high-risk families. So they were more apt to have either difficulties with the pregnancy, or in some cases it ended up being that their baby was stillborn, or they had a miscarriage, or their baby died early on as a newborn. They really were the idea people behind Resolve Through Sharing, because they wanted training for everyone who cared for these families, because they were there during, perinatal visits and things like that. But there were a lot of bedside people who felt uneasy when a baby died, and they weren't sure what to say or do. And these two nurses recognized that if we developed a training that was specific to healthcare providers, and it mostly nurses, but also social workers, chaplains, physicians, genetic counselors, child life specialists. There were others as well, but bedside nurses are always involved in someone's care when a baby dies. Mm-hmm. And so, based on some of the things they were doing, we developed a training program. Sarah Wheeler and I worked together on that. She was a clinical nurse specialist, and we worked together on a lot of things. I was the first coordinator of Resolve Through Sharing at Gunderson, which meant that my focus at the time we started was in-house, was what was going on all of the units where losses occurred. And so one of the things that I did was begin a parent support group. So we did have that for many years. And also, pretty early on, we started doing research, which of course makes practice evidence-based, which is so critical to what it is that we're preparing and giving to people when they come to a training. That still is true. There was a little research that was done in the 70s, and there were others that were that started with parent support groups. So you're right on target there. Those were some of the first things that were happening. I think we were the first to develop a really solid educational program for professionals.
Hmm.
That's what was missing. That's the piece that was missing when Resolve Through Sharing started.
I love the name, and I know it's a long, long time ago, but I suspect maybe you can remember at least some of the conversations that revolved around what this should be called. And I should think, because it was something quite new, maybe unprecedented even, that what this would be named was really significant. What can you tell us about the creation of this particular name, and why you think it is so very fitting for the central mission of what you do?
Well, yes, it took a lot of discussions and a lot of care went into it. I would say that from the beginning, Resolve Through Sharing focused on the importance of relationship and the power of a relationship to change an experience. So the training had to do with developing a relationship, sharing connection, sharing about the baby, sharing the parent's experience with a healthcare professional. So it was central, and we wanted it integrated into the name. And the resolve doesn't mean resolve in the sense of forgetting. It means that through a relationship, one comes to understand and appreciate the relationship that went into this experience of loss. And so that's really how this came about in the beginning, and we've kept it the same for all of these years for that reason.
I'm curious about the very outset of, in a sense, first of all, what had to happen to bring this into being? I mean, did you have to go to the administration at Gunderson and make the case for this to be needed? And tell us about that and what sort of reception you received.
We have a training for coordinators. The training for bedside people began in 81. That's what we considered the date that Resolve Through Sharing began. But in 1985, we developed a training for the coordinators, meaning that role that I had as being the, knowing what was going on all of the units that where losses occurred and making sure that care was delivered at the highest level, no matter where you went. It might be the emergency room. It might be the clinic. It might be inpatient GYN, which doesn't exist anymore in that particular format. But that's what coordinators do. They make sure that the program gets embedded. And that's what we had to do at Gunderson. And yes, it takes administrative support. Something like this doesn't work without that, because it involves changes in practice. It involves perhaps shuffling assignments so that you have the time you need to spend with this bereaved family. There are a lot of things that are involved that require training and mentoring, helping others grow and develop in their ability to care for people. So without administrative support, this would never have worked. We had I think the role would be director now, of the pediatric and the OBGYN areas, that chaired a planning committee. And that planning committee consisted of the disciplines that were going to be involved in making sure this worked. And also, for example, we had a neonatologist and a maternal fetal medicine specialist on this committee. They then went back to their physician colleagues and said, you know, this is coming down the pike. We want you to know about this. This training is going to be starting soon. And that, you know, that you, I know that you understand why communicating with your own discipline makes things work better. So, and there was a social worker, an administrator who was a social worker on that committee. There was a high-level chaplain that was on that committee. So all of these people were excited about it and wanted it to work. And because of their efforts and the excellent planning that went into this, they met for months before we actually had a training.
Wow.
So it was already accepted that we were going to do this. The other thing that happened that I think is worth talking about is that we didn't design this program for an international audience like we have now. We designed it for Gunderson and our families here. And Sarah and I spoke at several national conferences to talk about what we were doing here. And at one in particular, which has a large membership of maternal child nurses, and they were lined up afterwards wanting to buy our slides and asking us so many questions. And you know, we came back and said, we've got to do something about this. We knew that we could send our checklists, that we could send our protocols, that we could even send our slides, but that isn't what would help them implement a program. It was a much bigger picture than that. And again, we went to administration and they said, write a manual. And so we did. And in 1983, I think, we wrote it and premiered our training with this manual in 84. And we still use training manuals. Of course, they've changed a lot because we're always updating. But that sort of thing where you're paying attention to what people are asking for and also helping to understand what they actually need. They didn't need the slides. They needed education that included the slides.
Right.
So that also is a piece of when we talk about Resolve Through Sharing. That move from being an in-house internal program to being regional, national, and international was also a process of getting people on board.
Just to turn back the clock once again to kind of before Resolve Through Sharing was created. In a typical, for instance, Gunderson Hospital in, let's say, the 1960s or 70s, if a woman suffered this kind of loss, either a miscarriage or stillbirth or the loss of a very young child, was it possible for a given mother, in a sense, to kind of swim against the stream and insist on what they maybe thought they needed, as in, you know, seeing their child, holding their child or whatever? Or in a sense, was this set up in such a way that that was all but impossible? And maybe another way to ask this is, at that point in time, which now in so many ways seems like the Stone Age, are we talking about policy that was written down, I mean, and officially set in place? Or are we talking more about just kind of a culture, just kind of a general understanding of how these situations would be handled? I think it's important to know that, because then it's important to understand exactly what needed to be changed and how.
It's both. It's both the culture and the specifics. excuse me, I actually worked with mothers and babies at Gunderson prior to Resolve Through Sharing for a few years. And so I was experienced to know kind of what went on. And I would say it varied, because some nurses were really sensitive to this and others were uncomfortable. The same with physicians. They, you know, it was really new to pay attention to miscarriage. I mean, even physicians and nurses who worked in the clinic didn't think too much of it. They helped people with the medical condition of it, but the psychological condition was pretty new. So before Resolve Through Sharing, it sort of depended on who was there, and there was no protocol per se as to what was done. And we also started with checklists, and I'm wanting to say something about this for your listeners, because I'm afraid that the idea of a checklist might sound like routine, rote, no real thought that goes into it. A checklist, which has been proven with some very important research from Harvard, is a safety issue, and it's also a reminder of what is possible. You can't hold all of these things in your mind. You need something in front of you to remember to say, would you like this? Or, I can do this for you. Would you like to hold your baby now, or did you want to wait a little while? All of those things are part of a checklist that serves as a reminder of what can be done. So those were things that were developed when Resolve Through Sharing began. They did not exist prior to Resolve Through Sharing. And so I would say that with that being part of what one did, it also shifted the culture.
I assume.
Does that make sense?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah.
I assume that this was essentially required. I mean, that this was not an optional sort of enrichment exercise, but that if someone was going to work in this facet of the Gunderson Health System, that this was something that they had to do. They had to have this training. Am I right about that?
Yes. The term that we would have used is standard. It became a standard of care. And the certifying body for hospitals has a lot of different standards. And we fit in with one that they had about grief, although not specific to the death of a baby. But there was the big picture of standards, and then there was institution-based standards. So this became an institution-based standard.
Hmm. As you think about what you were telling your nurses then versus what nurses are told now, nurses and others who work for Gunderson, who undergo this training, how dramatically has that training changed over the years? I mean, obviously, modes of presentation have changed and others, specifics of that nature. But otherwise, in terms of the heart and soul, has very much changed? Or do you feel like, by and large, what you were advising, for instance, the typical nurse to do in 1981 or 83 or 85 is very much equally applicable today in 2023?
I don't think that the idea of developing and fostering and sustaining a relationship has changed. I think that was a core value of the program when it began, and it still is. What has changed, however, is the idea of evidence-based practice. That wasn't talked about much in 1981, but slowly, you know, 40 years, there's a lot that's happened in terms of research, for example. There are a lot of people doing research in this area now. That was not the case in 1981. So we have always been committed to providing the latest evidence to the people that are participants in our trainings so that they are familiar with what is a current practice, what things that we would consider now that we didn't in 1981. One example I would use is I just finished with another colleague of mine writing a guest editorial for a journal, a well-known journal in maternal child nursing. And in that guest editorial, we make a case for expanding perinatal bereavement to include mistreatment during the childbearing process, to include traumatic birth, which might be hemorrhage, which might be serious complications with blood pressure, which might be a difficult delivery, getting the baby out. And then we're also making a case that the death of the birthing person or mother is also perinatal bereavement. And we are making the case, and Resolve Through Sharing has already added these into the training for perinatal loss, because we believe that we can make a strong case that these situations can easily bring about fear, uncertainty, grief and loss, hesitation, and worry about both the birthing person and the baby. So that is an example of, we titled this Expanding Perinatal Bereavement. So it's adding to what could be in that domain and be accurate. And there's a lot of research that's been done particularly on mistreatment and traumatic birth. that didn't exist in 1981. So that's an example of how our field is growing and changing, and how we believe that it's our responsibility as a result of sharing to always stay familiar with these situations that are to be paid attention to, and where follow-up is done, for example, and that we're again developing relationships so that people can talk about how this was for them, because these situations can be difficult, and it can make the anticipation of having another baby difficult as well.
Sure.
They may be afraid that this same thing is going to happen. And the mistreatment can be scolding, using language that's not respectful, not paying enough attention to people, not using correct pronouns, not using the correct names. There are lots of ways that mistreatment can be shown. And we know now, because it's documented in research, that this is particularly true for those who are marginalized already. And we believe that we have to be so sensitive to not making them feel left out, uninformed, like they don't matter. They're experiencing that already in their lives. They should have a different experience when they have a baby.
Absolutely.
Whether the baby dies or lives, mistreatment is something that lingers with people. You remember those words. You remember that person who was careless in how they responded to you. Those are things that stick with you for a lifetime. And it's something we can change.
Of course. And of course, the converse is also extraordinary kindness that we are shown also can live on.
Absolutely.
For decades.
Absolutely.
I want to be sure to ask you about the fact that that nurses are come in all genders. And so, although I think, you know, forgive the stereotype, but I think still most of us, or at least people my age, when we think of a nurse, we immediately think of a woman, when in fact, of course, there are plenty of male nurses and other, in terms of gender, that are nurses. Is there kind of a special facet of this where you have to kind of think about the gender of the nurse? And, you know, for instance, the typical male nurse, do they face certain difficulties or challenges in forging a relationship with a mother who has suffered this kind of a loss? Or by and large, is this equally true, and does it work pretty much the same for any and all nurses?
Well, I guess that I would think about this in a larger context, which is adding physicians to the mix. And the fact that there are many women who are OBGYNs now, but you may well have a man who's taking care of you during pregnancy. There are also men who are midwives, by the way. And so I would say that it really depends on the way whoever it is that's taking care of you responds to you. And we would just accept the fact that, yes, there are different genders, and that's the way it is. It's that way with social workers. It's that way with nurses. It's that way with physicians. And, yes, I do believe that we may hold in our mind a stereotype, but we can quickly get over that, and the people that are providing the care can get over that by just simply focusing again on the relationship. How are you? How are you doing with all of this? I'm going to be with you this morning. What's on your mind? How can I best help you? Those are the sorts of things. It doesn't matter what gender you are if you're able to relate in that way.
Right, exactly.
Does that make sense?
Of course.
Yeah.
I also want to just take a minute or two to talk about this really important matter of follow-up. The fact that you believe that those who are caring for patients who have suffered this loss, that relationship I believe I understand this correctly, really needs to be an ongoing one. That the moment that patient, that woman who has suffered this loss, that when they are wheeled out of the hospital, that is not where the story ends for them, and the story doesn't end for those who have cared for them. Can you just say a quick word about the importance of that?
We do believe in follow-up, but I'm also going to say that in the context of today's health care, we have to be careful that we're not creating a standard that can't be met. And So for follow-up, for example, it might be that for the nurse, for example, that's taking care, let's say that a baby is stillborn, she takes care of the family, and she's considered their resolved through sharing nurse. The hospital may say, you don't have time, we cannot allot time to do follow-up, but you can send a card, which, by the way, is really meaningful. If you have some, you know, people that took care of a family during this very sad time, if they get a card with a meaningful note on it, it can mean, I mean, those are the kinds of things people save forever. So sometimes follow-up is that. There's more follow-up that's being done by email now, so it becomes part of the medical record and is therefore part of the care. But this also brings up another point, and I know you want me to be brief with this, but that's the interfacing with inpatient care and outpatient services. So between an inpatient unit, for example, labor and delivery, and the clinic, the ambulatory setting where someone goes for follow-up. So we also educate those people. We think it's really important that that they get acknowledgement when they come in for a checkup, whether that's at 3 weeks, 4 weeks, 6 weeks, that they are, their loss is acknowledged, and that there's clearly some link between what happens in the hospital and what happens in the clinic.
Well, of course, nothing can fully take away the pain of this kind of loss, but it is so good to think of doctors and nurses and others in the healthcare profession coming to these situations with a much deeper understanding than they otherwise might have in terms of how to help their patients through this to the very best of their ability. And that has been happening for more than 40 years with this outstanding program called Resolve Through Sharing, which I strongly suspect has been an inspiration for similar programs in other health systems across the country. One would certainly hope so.
We've trained about 60,000 at this point. And that we now have trainings in perinatal loss, neonatal pediatrics, and adult. So three separate programs. And of all of those, about 60,000 people.
Wow. An extraordinary legacy. Dr. Rana Limbo, Director Emerita and co-founder of the Resolve Through Sharing program. I thank you so much, first of all, for all of this amazing work that you have done through the years, you and your colleagues. And I thank you for being my morning show guest today. I was truly honored to speak with you. Best wishes.
Thank you. Thank you, Greg.
Tomorrow on the morning show, a lighter topic, we will be talking with Clayton J. Check about his book, A Field Guide to Tequila. On Thursday, Nan Calvert pays her monthly visit to the program, and she will have with her two very special guests, Aaron Houlihan and Ellie Barbeau, who are co-director and folk school instructor, respectively, of the Humble Oak Folk School. And this Friday, we will be talking about two really special events that are coming up this weekend. We'll be talking with Jessica DeBoer about the Sing-Along Messiah, which is coming up at First United Methodist Church this coming Sunday evening at 6 p.m. An opportunity to join in a performance of one of the greatest masterworks in music history. We also hope to preview Saturday night's concert by the Kenosha Pops Concert Band, their annual Christmas concert, which happens Saturday evening